Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar. The lines between science and spirituality are really starting to blur. There's such a great amount of growing body of evidence and research validating that consciousness exists outside the brain, and the brain simply acts as a receiver for our consciousness and our thoughts. And my guest today, Steve Taylor, talks about that, especially in his new book called Spiritual Science. Steve is a senior lecturer in psychology based at Leeds, Beckett University in the UK. And he gives several examples of this in his book. And he talks about the spiritual view of reality, how it really transcends both conventional science and religion. We're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back right after the break. I'm Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar. Is science and spirituality truly blending? Is that what our world really needs? And is that the way that we're going to make sense of our world? This is definitely the case, according to my guest, Steve Taylor, who is a senior lecturer in psychology at Leeds Beckett University in the UK. His books have been published in 19 languages, and articles and essays have appeared in over 50 academic journals and magazines and newspapers. His latest book is called Spiritual Science. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Such a great pleasure to speak with you, and I'm really interested in this topic, and I'm excited because finally, it's not just the material world any longer, is it, Steve?
No, it's not. I think the standard material explanation of the world just doesn't work anymore. There are so many things which can't be explained in material terms. And I think more and more scientists are beginning to realize that as we uncover more knowledge about the world. It becomes clearer and clearer that, the standard model cannot explain the world.
Well, the normal materialistic approach to science has served for a very long time, and I'd like it if you could tell us why that will no longer work.
Yeah, well, on a kind of on a very superficial level, the materialistic model works. It helps us to develop technology. It helps us to explore the world around us. But it's partly a question of deepening knowledge. There are more and more discoveries in genetics and evolution and the effect of the mind and the body, the way that the placebo effect works, or the way that the brain changes in the result of, as a result of mental activity. And these discoveries make it clearer and clearer that the standard model is too simplistic. But I think it's also a question of we're at a point in human history where we've been exploiting the world's resources for so long. We've been trying to accumulate more and more possessions to make us happier and happier. And in a kind of parallel level, it's become more and more evident that that's not working, that we need a kind of shift in the way that we see the world. We need a shift in the way that we relate to the world in order to live more harmoniously.
Yes, and I think it creates more polarity if you really look at things as so black and white without any gray in between, where we're really not allowed to blur those lines in that materialistic view. And so, go ahead.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that we're beginning to realize. There was an assumption in the standard materialistic model that human beings are separate to the world. We're kind of isolated entities moving through space.
And the body is separate than disease, and that we mind is separate than the body.
There were different kinds of separation: the separation of the mind and the body, the dualism of the mind and the body, but also the dualism between us and the world. The world is a machine, and we're machines, and we're just sort of moving through this empty space. But it's become more and more evident that in reality we are intimately interconnected. We participate in the world, and our own consciousness affects the world and influences the world all the time, just as our own mind influences the body all the time.
Yes. And so this, when we start to look at things in a different way, we start to come up and realize that it's everywhere, that everything is completely interconnected. And when I mentioned earlier that the consciousness is fundamentally outside of the brain and the mind, even, I had a near-death experience, and I experienced this firsthand of how the consciousness is all around us, and I experienced the sense of complete interconnectivity and oneness, and how possible that really truly is. And once you see that, in your mind's eye, you can never unsee it.
Yeah,
And
that's
there's,
difficult. Yeah.
I'm sorry, and there's a constant pursuit for it, which I'm sure you understand. So tell me a little bit
Yeah.
about that. The consciousness is outside the mind.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Yeah, once you experience that, you know, it changes your world forever, changes the way you see the world forever. And yeah, I mean, the standard view of the world, which most people are taught in schools, certainly in Europe, is that you know, matter is the fundamental reality of the world, and you can explain everything in terms of matter. You know, the mind is the result of brain activity, and everything can be explained in terms of the in terms of material particles like atoms, the interactions of atoms and cells. But yeah, my view is that the fundamental reality of the world is actually consciousness. I sometimes call it spirit or fundamental consciousness. And that means that the material world does not produce the mind. It's actually the other way around. Mind or consciousness produces the material world and produces the mind. Sorry, produces the brain. Because, you know, consciousness is a fundamental reality. It's kind of, it's the source of everything. And in some way, what we perceive as matter arises from consciousness. So, you know, the world didn't start accidentally. The universe didn't start accidentally. It kind of arose naturally from the kind of dynamic potential of consciousness. And that means that consciousness is everywhere around us. It's in us. It's in every atom of my body. It's in the space around us. It's in everything we see. And so, you know, we are interconnected with other human beings through this network of consciousness. We are interconnected with other living beings through this network of consciousness, and with the whole universe. And everything is the manifestation of consciousness, just as we are.
It doesn't, it makes perfect sense if you have this incredible brain that's connected by all of this neurological activity and this weaving of this wonderful infrastructure of the veins and the blood system and the body's innate ability to create homeostasis. Why would it just stop inside the skin? What would possibly, you know, you think about nature too. I mean, why would we just stop at the first, second, and third dimension? Nature's
Yeah.
far more creative than that, I
Yeah,
believe.
and we and yeah, you're right. And we experience it all the time. In every day we experience a kind of interconnection with other people. Even when we experience you know, empathy or compassion, that comes from this connection between us. And we can sense other people's suffering, other people's pain, because we are part of them. You know, we share the same consciousness as them. So, you know, when we feel the impulse to help people, to be altruistic to other people, that stems from this the interconnection between us, from the shared consciousness between us.
Can you share some of the scientific studies that are being done to validate this, what we're talking about?
Yeah, well, one interesting area is evolution. The kind of the standard model of evolution is that the kind of standard non-religious model is that evolution works through mutations, random mutations, and natural selection. But more and more biologists are beginning to feel that that model can't explain the creativity of evolution or the creativity of life. It can't explain the way that new forms can come into being. And there's a lot of interesting research showing that mutations happen exactly when they are needed in response to challenges in the environment. So they kind of naturally, there's a kind of natural creativity in life itself, which is dynamic, which suggests that, you know, nature is not completely random. You know, there's a kind of pattern in nature. There's a kind of dynamic, creative potential. And I think that's connected to consciousness as well. I think consciousness has this dynamic potential, which naturally encourages life forms to become more complex and to respond to challenges. And that's just one example of how the kind of you know, recent scientific findings have found that, you know, bacteria mutate themselves very, very quickly in response to changes to their environment, much more quickly than could be possible through accident or randomness.
Well, what about through thoughts and intentions?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a lot more research showing that human beings can affect
Bacteria.
our bodies, you know, our health through intention and through our thoughts. And the placebo effect is so interesting because a lot of conventional scientists just think it's a matter of belief. You know, if you believe that you feel better, then you feel better. It's just a question of sort of self-deception almost. But it's much more than that. You know, the placebo effects. Recent studies into the placebo effect have shown that real healing does take place. And neurological studies have shown that the areas of the brain associated with pain can be deactivated through hypnosis or through belief and intention.
And meditation,
So,
and yeah. Now,
yeah.
I mean, I like the fact that you combined that science needs spirituality, and that's the one of the subtitles there. Science needs spirituality to make sense of the world. Are there a large number of scientists that are starting to believe the same way?
I wouldn't say it's a large number, but it's certainly growing.
Growing, that's good.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of a movement in that direction.
It's a movement.
I mean, so, sorry?
It's a movement, which is good.
It's a movement, yeah. I mean, just what I was saying about evolution, there's a movement of scientists. Now, conventional mainstream scientists they've developed a movement called the Third Way in evolution. And they're trying to develop an alternative to creationism on one hand, and an alternative to neo-Darwinism. So kind of a third way, a more complex and nuanced way of understanding evolution.
What's it called?
But
The
yeah,
third what?
the third way of evolution.
So it's a combination of creationism and the Big Bang Theory.
Not really a combination. It's kind of it's an alternative to them. You know, they think that both of those ways are too simplistic. And that they can't explain, well, the Darwinian model can't explain the creativity of life and the way that new organs and new life forms can come into being in a very rapid way.
Fascinating. Now, what do you believe?
What do I believe? Well, I believe, you know, I haven't had a near-death experience like you, but I've had a lot of spiritual experiences, you know, higher states of consciousness. Through meditation or just spontaneously, you know, when I'm in contact with nature and in different situations. And my own experiences tell me that there is this fundamental consciousness, that the fundamental reality of the universe is this kind of awe-inspiring web of shared being, if you like. And it has a quality of bliss in my experience. And it feels like coming home, just like you said with your near-death experience, it feels like coming home when you touch into this fundamental consciousness or this spirit, you could say. It makes you feel, you know, it's like breathing a sigh of relief. You know, you say to yourself, wow, this is the way things really are. This is the fundamental truth of life, this harmony and this bliss. And yeah, once you feel that, it has a tremendous, you could say, noetic quality, a tremendous sort of sense of revelation. You know somehow that this is the way things really are. And you know, it changes your life, and you can never see the world in a
The
kind of
same.
simplistic, material way again.
Right. It's just like looking out at the vastness of the ocean. And if you haven't seen it for a long time and you know that it connects to another piece of land far, far away, you know that it does. But you can't
Yeah.
see it from the perspective you're at.
Right, yeah. It's also realizing that you're a wave on the ocean, you know. I think in ordinary consciousness, there's a tendency to think that you are a kind of separate, autonomous being, almost like a wave that's forgot that it's part of the ocean. But when you have this experience, it's like, yeah, I am connected to the ocean. I am one with the whole ocean. And I'm one with all the other waves, all the people and all the living beings around me. We're all manifestations of the same ocean.
Okay, well, if we think about it though, think about the massive devastation that's happening to our ocean right now and the radiation that's pouring into the ocean by the tons across the ocean. And it's, you know, how do you, when you really connect into this, it could be a good feeling, but if you also think about it, there's a lot there that is not going right.
Well, that's true, but I think that comes from the sense of separation. You know, we have this sense of separation between the mind and the body, but probably equally seriously, we have this sense of separation between us and nature. To continue the theme of separation, I think many human beings do feel themselves to be separate from the world around them, separate from nature. And they also feel a desire to dominate nature. And I think that comes from separateness. If you feel you are separate to something, then in some way you feel threatened by it, kind of overwhelmed by it almost, and you feel a desire to dominate it and to exploit it, to have a sense of power and control. I think that explains our relationship to nature and the way that we destroy and pollute nature so easily.
Yes, it
And
makes
there are so
sense.
many indigenous groups who have a much healthier relationship to nature than we do, because
Yes.
they don't feel separate to it. They feel bonded to nature. And they feel empathic because nature is part of their being. Their landscape is part of their being. So they feel a strong desire to look after nature, to respect
As if it
nature.
were, as if we're one with it. In your book, you talk about panspiritism. What is that?
Well, panspiritism is my alternative view of the world to materialism. There's actually a philosophy called panpsychism, which literally means all is mind. And the basic idea of panpsychism is that all material particles have a mental element to them. So even the tiniest atom has a little sort of flicker of consciousness in it. So in a sense, all material particles are conscious. And that explains where consciousness comes from, because consciousness was always there. It's always there in every particle. But my view is slightly different to that, because in what I call panspiritism, consciousness is not just in particles, it's not just in matter. It's actually in everything. It's in space as well. It fills the whole of space. And consciousness gave birth to matter. It gave birth to the whole universe. All material things have their source in consciousness. So panspiritism basically means all is spirit, or spirit is everywhere. And it's quite similar to some of the world's spiritual traditions, like Hindu Vedanta, which says that Brahman, or spirit, is the source of everything, and Brahman pervades everything. So it's a similar view of the world, but my suggestion in my book is that whereas materialism can't really explain the world, it's pretty much failed as a way of explaining the world and as a way of explaining human experience. But if you substitute that for a spiritual model, for panspiritism, then suddenly, the world makes much more sense, and a lot of the puzzles of the world begin to be solved.
It's just like the power of imagination. Everything that is created has to have been imagined first.
Yeah, well, everything that's created has to have the same source. There's this tremendous sort of creative dynamic potential in consciousness, which gives rise to life forms, to material particles. And once those particles or those forms arise, then they are naturally kind of impelled to become more complex. So that explains evolution, in my view, the way this kind of this dynamic creative potential of life to move to more complex forms. And the way that life forms become more conscious over time, consciousness seems to increase over time throughout history as living beings become more complex.
Yes, and that thus evolution occurs. Absolutely. There's so much more to talk about here, and we're going to take a quick break. And I want to find out more about how you combine science and spirituality and how it's interdependent, which is also a wonderful philosophy, which in itself, one can't exist without the other. All right, we will be right back with my guest, Steve Taylor, talking about spiritual science. I am Lisa Gar, and you're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is Steve Taylor. The book that we're talking about is called Spiritual Science: Why Science Needs Spirituality. And I'm curious, by the way, Steve is a senior lecturer in psychology at the psychology department at Leeds Beckett University in the UK. Do you ever have, Steve, debates with other scientists that are materialists that have that approach to science? What do they say about this? Are they open at all?
Sometimes, but they tend to be, to be honest, they tend to be quite dogmatic. Almost as if they, you know, they're not too dissimilar from religious people in a way. They have a particular belief system, which is materialism, and you know,
They're
they're
pretty
quite
committed to
defensive
it,
about
right?
it. Yeah, they're quite defensive about it. Just in the same way that, you know, sometimes if you question the beliefs of religious people, they get defensive, and they reach for kind of for reasons not to believe you, and so just to dismiss the evidence you present to them. Sometimes it's the same with my scientific colleagues. You know, they just dismiss out of hand the evidence for telepathy, for example. I'm convinced that there is a lot of, you know, very compelling evidence for the existence of telepathy,
Can you share some
but a
of
lot
that
of
with us?
just a lot of people are just not willing to look at the evidence.
Right. And I mean, Einstein obviously looked beyond, and he was quite the scientist. If he hadn't, we would all, be unaware.
Yeah, in actual fact, there are some scientists who are open to the existence of telepathy. Even you know, really famous scientists like Alan Turing, the computer scientist who helped to develop the modern whole modern world of computing, he was convinced of the evidence for psychic phenomena.
Ah, interesting. Yes, it does seem to create great scientists.
Yeah, well, I think that's because it's all about openness. You know, science should really be about openness. It shouldn't really be about you know, developing a certain view of the world and clinging to that view and defending yourself against evidence for that view.
Right.
It should be about just, you know, being open to whatever's out there and being willing to
Expand.
adapt your views to the evidence.
Yes, so now speaking of evidence, evidence of telepathy, what is that?
Well, telepathy is the exchange of information or the intuiting of information between human minds that are not connected physically or directly. So, in my view of the world, telepathy works through the shared consciousness we all possess. You know, in the same way that, in a sense, we can feel each other's pain and suffering through empathy, and that, you know, encourages us to respond in kindness and generosity to other people. But in the same way, we can sometimes, in some circumstances, sense what other people are thinking, you know, in the same way that we can sense what other people are feeling.
We can. Has this been replicated in scientific experiments that you know of, that you're aware of?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, you know, just to give you an indication of how even mainstream science is changing a little bit and becoming more open to these phenomena, in the new issue of the American Psychologist Journal, which is the magazine of the American Psychological Association, kind of like the preeminent psychological journal, there's an article about psychic phenomena, such as telepathy and precognition. And it's a very, you know, it's a very kind of open article suggesting that the evidence is quite compelling. And it's really evidence that's been accumulated over decades. You know, these experiments have been undertaken for many, many decades now. And if you do a kind of a meta-analysis of all of the experiments, all of the hundreds of experiments over the years, you get really, you know, compelling statistical evidence for the existence of these phenomena. And over the last few decades, the experiments have become much more rigorous, much more controlled, you know, to omit any possible random effects. And so, you know, many modern psychic experiments are much more controlled than other scientific experiments. So the evidence, you know, is even more compelling.
The military uses it, and remote viewers have been random and double-blind studied, and it's quite phenomenal. Have you tried this yourself?
I've done some sort of not scientific experiments, some sort of informal experiments with telepathy, with telephone telepathy. I don't know if you heard of telephone telepathy. Or even email telepathy, which is when I had an interesting experience of email telepathy last night, actually. I decided that I was on the train from London to Manchester, my hometown, and I suddenly had this thought: I should email my friend Henry, because I saw him a few weeks ago, and he was very kind to us when we were abroad. And I said, just email to thank him. So I opened up my computer, opened up my Yahoo inbox, And there was an email from Henry, my friend, that he sent just a few minutes ago, at exactly the same time that I thought of emailing him. So that's kind of email telepathy. But yeah, I mean, everybody is familiar with these experiences. In telephone telepathy, in my experiences, in my kind of informal experiments, I've tried, there were four different friends of mine who I asked to ring me at a certain time, and I had to guess which one. I asked them all to ring me, and obviously one of them would come through first, and I had to guess, I had to write down which person I thought came through first on the phone. And I found that I guessed correctly most of the time, you know, it was much higher than chance.
That's a good idea.
We're all familiar with these experiences, telephone telepathy, email telepathy, all kinds of telepathy.
It doesn't work if you have caller ID, though.
No, that's true.
You have to do it on a landline.
But you don't need it.
That's true. Which I love. I love these types of experiments because it's just showing evidence of what we already know. How do you think that it can be replicated, especially in the case of spontaneous remission? That would be nice to recreate, wouldn't it?
That would be great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't get much publicity, but there are many groups of researchers around the world who are working in these areas and attempting to replicate findings. Mm-hmm. And there's a great institute in Portugal called the Beale Institute, who funds a lot of research into psychic phenomena and the influence of the mind over the body. And you know, I think more and more studies are emerging and helping to, you know, influence the way that mainstream science, helping to, you know, create a more holistic and alternative vision of the world.
So if we are all interconnected, and that's been proven in many different ways, is there ever an existence or scientific studies being done on unseen beings? Beings without bodies?
Well, there are. Funny enough, I was at a conference yesterday in London, and there was a researcher from America, I think she was from the University of West Georgia, and she presented a paper on apparitions. And basically, her research was about what kind of people are more likely to see apparitions. She didn't use the term ghost, but obviously included that phenomenon. And she concluded that there was people who were more likely to be creative and imaginative, but also people who, there's a term called transliminality, which means that your kind of mental boundaries are not as fixed as other people's, so you're more open to kind of external influences, external phenomena, and you're kind of less restricted by your own ego, less kind of ego boundaried, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And those kind of people, according to this research, are more likely to experience apparitions. So there is research in this area.
Interesting. It's interesting. I mean, I know that there's a lot of research that's been done on the near-death experiencers and what that could be. I was interviewing Evan Alexander recently, and the neurosurgeon who had the coma experience. And when I said, could that possibly happen within different parts of the brain lighting up or going offline and so forth, what do you feel about that? Could it just be a phenomenon of the brain? And usually there's trauma associated with near-death experiences.
No, I don't think, I think that's impossible that it could be the result of brain activity. Partly because, you know, in Eben Alexander's experience, for example, he was in a coma and his level of brain activity was so low, so minimal, that it couldn't possibly produce that level of, conscious experience. And in near-death experiences, you know, they occur in moments when the brain is effectively dead. So you have the question, how can an inactive brain possibly produce conscious experience? Mm-hmm. And sometimes skeptics say, oh, well, it could just be happening before people become unconscious or as they become conscious again. But But there are lots of arguments against that. You know, people sometimes say that near-death experiences are the result of a lack of oxygen to the brain. But if you look at sort of clinical evidence for the symptoms of a lack of oxygen to the brain when that experience occurs in other settings, they are actually nothing like near-death experiences. They're very sort of chaotic, crazy, hallucinatory experiences, whereas near-death experiences are very ordered, very structured, and there's a sense of kind of enhanced reality about them, which you don't get from hallucinatory experiences.
Hmm.
So I think, you know, you can't explain near-death experiences in terms of brain activity. They seem to show that they're just one of the many different phenomena which show that the brain or brain activity does not produce mental activity. There's no direct relationship between mental activity and brain activity. I mean, obviously, the brain helps to produce consciousness, but it doesn't directly produce consciousness. And therefore, there are many different situations where mental experience or conscious experience can be independent of the brain.
I wonder if the same thing is true for psychedelics and different types of psychedelic drugs. I know that there's, you know, a lot of research that's being done now on these experiences where these psychedelic drugs tend to help you access different areas of the mind.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with any of these at all?
Some of them, yeah. There's research showing that, you know, psychedelic experience, it definitely enhances consciousness. You know, consciousness becomes more intense in psychedelic experiences, almost as if, you know, I mean, I've always felt this is one of my kind of core insights, if you like, that's run through all of my writings, and it's that that our normal experience of the world is quite limited and restricted, and we only perceive the world in a kind of half-real, shadowy way. And, you know, the world is it's a familiar place to most of us. By the time we're adults, you know, we've had most of our experiences many times, and our lives, you know, the world around us becomes quite familiar. We kind of become desensitized to it.
Mm.
But in psychedelic experience, you know, the doors seem to open again, the gates seem to open, and the world becomes an incredibly real place again. You know, as if filters fall away, and suddenly, wow, this is how the world really is. It's so intensely, vividly real. A bit like the way children perceive the world. You know, it's a bit like stepping back into that amazing, vivid, fresh perception of being a child.
Fresh, new. The brain loves newness, doesn't it? Love that dopamine release when it sees or experiences something new?
Yeah, well, I think human beings in general, we love newness. That's why we love vacations, because they consist of newness. And,
true.
You know, there's amazing amount of stimulation and exhilaration that comes from putting yourself in unfamiliar surroundings. Or just having new experiences. We love new experiences because, in a sense, they wake us up. You know, they make the world more real to us.
Definitely, yes. And so if those types of experiences can exist in the brain, what you're saying is that the consciousness exists outside of the brain.
Yeah, I'm saying that there's no direct connection between the brain and consciousness. I mean, there are so many examples of this. For one recent example I've been reading about is cases of people who miss massive amounts of normal brain tissue. Now, there was a French guy about 10 years ago. He had a brain scan, a kind of routine brain scan for the first time in his life. And it was discovered that there was a massive hole in the middle of his brain.
Mm.
He was missing like almost 85% of normal brain tissue. And rather than being present in the normal areas, his brain tissue was just squeezed into the edge of his brain. But even then, there was still a massive amount of it missing. But he, up to then, he'd lived a normal life. He worked for the French government.
Huh.
He had two children.
Mm.
And all the time, there was this massive area of his brain missing.
And he didn't know it?
He didn't know it, no. there are many cases of this. So it shows that, you know, there is no direct connection. It shows, in a way, that the mind or consciousness makes the best of the brain that it can. You know, it kind of, it's almost like playing a musical instrument. You know, if your musical instrument is damaged, you can, if you're a good musician, you can work your way around it and play different notes in different places so that people don't really notice. And the so the the mind is like that. It kind of plays through the mind. The music of the mind plays through the brain rather than coming directly from it.
That's interesting. It does. And the so when we have these experiences and we leave the thought, like the analytical thought pattern, we have something that's more of a timeless, interconnected feeling. Is that the way that you explain this this blend of consciousness being outside or maybe combining with the brain?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, there are many, if you're in a deep state of meditation, and I've experienced this quite a few times myself, you can sometimes reach a point where your mind becomes completely inactive. There are no more thoughts running through your mind, and you're not processing perceptions from the world around you. So your mind is completely quiescent, completely silent. And suddenly, it's almost as if you touch into something very deep and fundamental, something which is way beyond your normal, the normal surface of your mind. And it is almost like touching into an ocean. Suddenly you become part of this ocean of consciousness, and you no longer have a sense of your body anymore. You seem to expand beyond your body, and you feel, in a way that's quite difficult to describe, you feel connected to everything. You feel that you are part of the whole universe. Even that you are the whole universe. Your identity seems to spread out into the whole universe. And I think that what's happening here is that we're just touching into fundamental consciousness. We're touching into spirit, the essence of reality. We are, concepting the essence within us. And in a sense, at the same time, we're concepting the essence of every living being and the essence of the universe itself.
In a way, if the majority of people, or more than the majority of people, believed this way, it would shift the way that we live in our universe. If we really truly knew the impact of our emotions or our thoughts or our actions on all of human consciousness, it would change the way that we live.
Certainly, yeah, it would change everything, I think one thing that would change is that the people would no longer seek well-being through accumulating wealth and power or through controlling other people. I think that the urge to gain power over other people, the urge to gain status, the urge to become wealthy and to accumulate possessions.
It's been around for so long, though, Steve. It's been around for a long time.
I know, but I think it stems from the sense of separation. If you feel that you are separate, then you feel there's a kind of basic insecurity, a basic sense of lack that you have because you're like a fragment that's been taken out of the whole. And therefore, you feel this urge to accumulate things to kind of strengthen yourself.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, Steve. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation and take your calls as well. My guest is Steve Taylor, and I'm Lisa Garr. I'll be right back.